And boom, welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon. We have Anya on today. She is on Instagram at The Calculated Mind, and that's at The Calculated Mind with underscores. It's not just, I'll tag it in the Instagram post. You guys will be able to find it. But I'm really excited to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell the listeners where you're talking to us from and kind of what you're doing with your life today?
Okay. I'm currently in Mobile, Alabama. I grew up in North Carolina, and then I moved here about a year ago because my boyfriend started residency here.
As in medical school residency?
Yes. So he's
very cool.
Internal medicine. And so I've been doing kind of different roles. I'm a social media manager for the Support Network, which is a nonprofit, and we're on multiple campuses doing peer support initiatives. And I also am involved in suicide research at the University of South Alabama, even though that's kind of on halt right now, at least for my role, because everything's a little bit of a mess right now.
Yes.
And I do some mental health blogging and writing every now and again. So I'm just kind of doing different things and victim advocacy. So I've been involved with a rape crisis center here and working on training for that victim advocate role.
Very cool. Very cool. And then you also live with mental illness, correct?
Yes, I do. I have bipolar 1.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. Well, yeah. So I guess before we kind of get into your, you know, your history, how you kind of turned into this, you know, online advocate, which is very cool. And I, of course, you know, have the utmost respect for anyone who chooses to live this way. How is coronavirus, though, impacting your management of bipolar disorder?
I think that I'm doing okay because I am on medication and I'm not in a place right now where I'm changing any of that. And so I'm stable and good. If I were depressed or manic, I'm pretty sure that this situation would worsen that because don't have the normal coping mechanisms available or support system, like can't go out and meet people and all of that. But for right now, I think I'm doing pretty okay.
Yeah, I kind of have a similar attitude. I feel like I'm doing as good as I can do given the situation, but I don't think I would define it as good. I'm just like, yeah, you know, I'm okay. I'm getting by, hanging in there. I feel, you know, obviously I think everyone has been challenged by coronavirus mentally, but you know, especially people with mental illness, I almost feel like it's a self-inflicted depression. Like it's almost like a forced depression that we're all living through right now because we're all forced to be isolated, you know, distancing from everyone around us. Like you said, we can't interact with anybody. And for me, that's how I kind of treat some of my depression, is interacting with others and just connecting. And I have found this time to be incredibly, incredibly challenging.
I think it can also go both ways, though, because I think people who are used to an abnormal level of anxiety or maybe even self-isolation during a depressive episode, just kind of isolating themselves, maybe are more used to some of these circumstances to some extent.
Yeah.
I read an article, I think, about some people with a history of anxiety issues or even trauma issues where some of this they're already familiar with. And so it's not affecting them as badly as it is some people who have never experienced anything like this before.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense. And you know, when I look at myself, I'm very much an extrovert. You know, I love talking, I love connecting. But you know, maybe someone who is more on the introvert side, or maybe has challenges with social anxiety, or like you said, you know, maybe they have some trauma history and they get triggered by going out in crowds. You know, maybe this actually can be a time in their life where they can make quite a deal of progress, because, you know, we are in this weird, unique situation.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the individual. Everyone is coping differently.
So, you know, I wanted you to be able to tell the listeners kind of about your advocacy work, which areas you like discussing the most. But, you know, before we get into that, I kind of want to paint a picture for the listeners. You know, how did you get to where you are today? And you know, so when did you start to interact with sort of the mental health system? When did you start to have any kind of mental health challenges in your life?
Sure. So I didn't struggle with my mental health whatsoever. It really wasn't anything on my mind other than maybe anxiety related to school and having kind of like a perfect GPA, that kind of thing. But mental illness wasn't on my mind until halfway through college. The summer after my sophomore year, I was hit with like a severe depressive episode. It just kind of came out of nowhere. And I know a lot of people seem to think that there should be like a major trigger. And really, I can't identify anything. And I don't have a family history either. So I wasn't really anticipating anything like that. And I think it was kind of scary to experience, because my family and friends, I don't think any of us had anticipated something like that, and we weren't familiar with it really. Like just a really severe, depressive episode that just hit really fast. And,
how old were you then?
So I think I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah. So
let's pause there. So what did this depression look like for you? You know, and in whatever comfort level you feel of disclosure, but you know, did you get to the point where, oh, I don't know, you were drinking to cope heavily? Were you self-harming? Were you isolating? Or what was depression for you then?
Sure. There's definitely a lot of self-isolation, because I felt like, I guess, I didn't deserve to have friends. Like, that was kind of my mindset. Really, really a lot of negative, anxious, spiraling thoughts. Just like one negative thought leading to another. It was, I think, anxiety paired with depression, paired with SI. And so I think, I don't know.
SI, like, for the listeners, is suicidal ideation. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. So I don't really know why. It just feels like someone pressed a self-destruct button or something in my head, and all of a sudden all I could think about was that kind of negative things, and depressive thinking just kind of dictated my thoughts 24/7. And I wasn't sleeping normally. I was kind of agitated. I really couldn't think through anything, and my mind kind of felt like it was dying. Like, I really couldn't think normally, and it really felt like my brain was dying.
I think that's a great way to almost picture it. You know, my brain was dying. You know, I feel like when we think of mental illness, we think of all these nebulous concepts and chemical imbalances, you know, but if you think of it just like, yeah, my organ of the brain was literally dying. And so I think that's a great way to put it.
Thanks. And I think there are a lot of the typical cliche thoughts, like hopelessness and, oh, I'm a burden on everyone, and the future is just going to be horrible, and all of this stuff. And it wasn't really based on anything in reality. But for me, that was real. It was very real to me.
So, you know, you're in this crazy state of depression. Did you, you mentioned, you know, you had your friends and, you know, they were really, you know, worried about you, freaked out. Did you immediately seek care or did you resist seeking care?
I went to one therapist and I only went to her once because I felt like she was saying like, oh, you're not really talking. So, you know, you can just write down some of your thoughts and, oh, you like Zumba, you can just go to a Zumba class. And I heard that and thought, oh, you're not taking me seriously. Like, you think I can just like go work out and be fine. Like, this is just, I'm sad. So that professional, I felt like wasn't taking me seriously. So I went to a psychiatrist who put me on an SSRI, so put me on an antidepressant, and I took that for a while, and I was diagnosed with depression at that point.
Okay, and you know, when you started that SSRI, did your life improve, or did it really have no effect?
With that medication, I eventually became hypomanic, but I also stopped it on my own. So I don't know whether I became hypomanic in response to taking it or because I was off it, I became hypomanic. And so that time is kind of blurred. But I did eventually get a bipolar diagnosis. So being on that type of medication wouldn't suit me anyway.
Well, yeah, let's pause there. You know, it sounds like you and, you know, you're dating someone who's in the medical community. It sounds like you have a very good understanding of these medicines. But just so the listeners actually understand, it's actually a classic medical school question. You know, this pops up on my boards kind of all the time. When someone like yourself who has a bipolar diagnosis, but they're misdiagnosed as having depression or maybe an anxiety disorder, they typically get put on an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or an SNRI, a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And what that can do for someone who has bipolar disorder is not necessarily immediately, but it can throw them into a manic or hypomanic state. And it's very, very scary. And we don't exactly understand why that is, but it seems to be a pretty well accepted phenomena of these medicines. And I've always kind of wondered, like, I wonder if we could almost use that in the future as a diagnostic tool to see if people actually are on the bipolar spectrum. However, there's of course a lot of dangers with that. You know, with mania, people can involve in risky behavior or start to have psychosis and not know what's real and what's not. And it of course can be very, very dangerous. So you kind of had a hypomanic episode. Like, can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So I think you just used the term scary when referring to the episode, but I think that's kind of funny because it's all about perspective. So if it's at the hypomanic level, especially, I think, me being the patient, I didn't find any problem with it. I thought everything was pretty normal because during such an episode, self-awareness can kind of go down. So other people were noticing all these differences, like excessive energy, inability to sleep, the goal-oriented behavior. Like, I was blogging nonstop, but really in a way that was kind of obsessive. And sending messages to people all the time and really like in an excessive manner. Everything was just over the top. And so other people saw it as an issue, whereas I was trying to state that everything was kind of normal. Like, oh, I was just depressed and now I'm better. So why can't you just be happy for me? Because everything's fine. But really, they were recognizing that, hey, like, this is not your normal. This is not okay. Even if I was still in denial about that at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put that, Anya. You know, when I was in my manic state, at least at the initial stage of it, towards the end, I had some paranoia, and that was not enjoyable. But at the beginning, like you said, I was having a great time. It was almost like a party for me. I was, you know, I literally was partying, you know, but I was staying up all night. I was spending a lot of money excessively. I remember I bought a PlayStation and like all these games. I bought like 5 kegs on one credit card, but you know, it was enjoyable to me. I was having the time of my life, but to everyone around me, they were freaked out, you know?
Right.
So I'm sorry, go on. What happened after that hypomanic, or how did you get out of that hypomanic?
So I went to the psychiatrist, and then I was put on a antipsychotic, I believe. And so that psychiatrist said, "Hey, you're no longer allowed to be on that type of medication that you were before, the antidepressant. So we're going to put you on this different medication." And I was on that for a while. But I'm kind of concerned because at that point, being bipolar was not brought up at all. And I feel like it should have been brought up as a consideration, because in my mind, I was thinking, oh, I had this really, really like random depressive episode one summer, and it'll never happen again. Like, I'm fine. I didn't even think that, hey, maybe I have a mood disorder that is chronic that I'm going to have to treat for the rest of my life. Like, that was not my mindset at all.
Interesting. So did you get a different diagnosis at that time, or?
I mean, I was never told of a different diagnosis at that time. When I did get a different diagnosis, it was when I felt like I was becoming manic, and it was becoming another level. It was no longer hypomania. Several months later, when I was in a abnormal psych class, and I had to write a paper about the Silver Linings Playbook and diagnosing that character, the main character, and I was looking through the DSM, and then I was connecting to the manic criteria and identifying that myself, which was pretty alarming.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh wow, this is happening, and this is happening right now. And that was pretty overwhelming, and I told one of my professors too, and he gave me contact to a clinical psychologist who did evaluate me and who diagnosed me with bipolar disorder. But then also shortly after that, I ended up being hospitalized twice for mania, 1 week in January of 2016 and then in February of 2016.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, you know, you were hospitalized, you know, and twice, you know, I certainly didn't enjoy my time in the hospital. I luckily only have been hospitalized once. You know, and I'm very happy to know that you're doing better than you were in that time of your life. Now, leaving the psych hospital, what was it like? Did you finally figure out how to properly balance, or was it slow and gradual? Like how, what did that look like for you, and what changes in your life did you make?
I think that I was very, well, I was accepting of the bipolar diagnosis because I was the one who went to the clinical psychologist initially and was asking basically for that diagnosis for clarification to see if that's what the issue was, because I could identify that what I was experiencing was not abnormal. I mean, was not normal. Mm-hmm. But I think the hospital experience for me also was not a pleasant one. And I felt like there wasn't collaboration, really. I felt like I was being told what to do. Like, you have to take this medication, or like, we're not going to let you out, kind of thing. Like, that's how it felt like. And so I was very resistant to the medications I was being put on, because also I felt like they were taking me from mania to like way too far down. I felt like I was becoming depressed and I felt like I wasn't being heard. Which it's just a lot of frustration being a patient in the psych hospital. And so I didn't like that, but I did find an outpatient psychiatrist who made me feel a lot more like it was a collaboration rather than him telling me what to do. And he was willing to discuss different options. And so I really appreciated him. And so that helped me, I think, find a better fit in terms of a provider and treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry you just had a bad experience in the inpatient setting. And quite frankly, it seems kind of commonplace. You know, my experience in the psych ward was not that enjoyable either. You know, I remember just kind of, yeah, the first meds I was put on did not make me really feel any better. And I almost tried to hide my symptoms from the psychiatrist because I was so desperately afraid that I would have to go back to the psych ward, and that was the last thing I want to do. And in many ways I still have that same feeling today. I really don't ever want to have to go back. I know that it's possible I may have to. But really almost like that drive is what drove me into medical school, and why I want to become a psychiatrist is because I hope that I can improve the setting of a psych ward in some way. I just, you know, my time in the psych ward, I just remember being bored as hell. And I remember just, I would pace the hallways and like, they had these little groups and stuff. And, you know, they had some, you know, television playing, like some daytime stupid TV, but it was awful. So, you know, you're in that outpatient setting. You finally found a good psychiatrist. Did you also link up with a good therapist? And what other coping mechanisms did you start to develop?
Right. I've tried various therapists. Unfortunately, I have not found one, I guess, that I've really connected with. And so I would like to try that at some point. But I just haven't yet, I guess.
Yeah.
I do a lot of reading on my own. I've read a ton of books on bipolar disorder and ones on therapy. And I obviously see the benefits of it. I just personally haven't connected with a therapist.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, I don't think that there is necessarily a perfect way to manage bipolar, and it really has to be individualized. You could say that, I guess, with any mental illness, you know, it just, and it's great that you were doing your reading on your own. And, you know, so outside of therapy then, you know, you weren't really using that, but you were doing a lot of like reading about, you know, self-improvement or management of your illness, trying to become educated. But, you know, did you make any changes to your exercise, to your social interactions, meditation, sleep schedule, or anything else?
So I think that it's good to identify personal red flags, and some of them are pretty common. For example, if someone is all of a sudden barely sleeping, as I was during the manic episode, I might have slept maybe 2 to 3 hours a night and then felt super energized. So if I had a sleep change like that, then I would be able to identify that and see that that's not normal. Or the opposite, if I were sleeping, like say 12 hours a day, I would be able to identify that and say, hey, that's not normal. So there are some personal red flags. And it might also be, for example, withdrawing from people and not feeling very social. And so there are just things that I think it helps to keep in mind, these various things, whether it's social or appetite, sleep. They're really not like that complicated, but it's just something to keep, I think, in the back of my mind at all times.
Certainly. So then what I'm most then curious about is, you know, so many people in this world live with, of course, many different types of mental illness, and it's estimated maybe about 4% of the world lives with bipolar disorder. But why did you choose to start to be public about your bipolar disorder, and what happened that made you want to turn to advocacy work?
Sure. So this probably isn't the best answer, but I think I basically outed myself while manic in December 2015. So I started my blog then. And
that blog is, just so the listeners can find it again?
It's The Calculating Mind at thecalculatingmind.com. So I started my blog, and I became really fascinated with mental health and with stigma, and kind of feeling like I'm on a mission to save all these people and to fight stigma for everyone and all of that. And when I was creating my blog, then I was wondering whether or not to be anonymous. And then I thought that it would kind of almost be silly if I were telling all these people that they shouldn't be ashamed of their diagnosis and their condition while also keeping my own a secret. So I think I basically did the complete opposite, where I was talking about bipolar all the time on my blog openly. And then I extended that to different platforms. And I've obviously continued that way beyond my manic episode. and that's because it's not just like a manic goal or anything. It's something that I think is really important, because it's a way to connect with people and show that they are not alone. And it's a way to educate people on the condition, because a lot of people, they may think that something is up, but they might not be willing to seek help because of stigma and all these other things. But I think stories allow them to connect and to feel less alone and maybe more likely to seek help if they need it.
Well, and I really like that answer, and I can relate to it, I think, quite a bit. You know, I think a lot of some of the best decisions I've made in my life were actually when I was either manic or maybe hypomanic. You know, I remember why I decided to kind of really be public, a public advocate, is the Sandy Hook shooting. And, you know, that shooting that happened at the elementary school in Connecticut, I grew up right by there. And I had this very visceral hypomanic reaction for a few days where I couldn't sleep. I was just so pissed off and frustrated. And similar to you, I decided then I just wanted to really push and start fighting stigma. And I couldn't live in this world where I complained about stigma, but I didn't do anything about it. And then also I've had, you know, hypomanic states. Like, I think that's why I started this podcast. You know, I was having some really creative ideas in a hypomanic state. I remember a hypomanic state kind of almost gave me the idea to pursue medical school. And I kind of thought it was dumb and crazy and wild, because I was like, oh, that's just a stupid mania idea. But then I started thinking, like, well, I could try it. You know, who knows what happened? And look, here we are. So, well, you know, so what aspects of your advocacy, you know, are you most passionate about? I see you doing videos. I saw you have like an animated series on YouTube. You've also done, it seems like, a lot of guesswork on different platforms. I saw you on the BP Hope magazine, The Mighty, and I'm sure there's more. So what are you most passionate about when it comes to your advocacy?
Sure. I think the most recent thing that I'm focusing on is suicide prevention, because I recently connected with people online through social media, through Twitter. There's, for example, SPSM chat, which is suicide prevention social media, and they have a weekly chat where they talk about various topics in the suicide context. And I'm also getting involved with some research here, and there just seems to be so many gaps and just so much room for the field of suicidology to grow. And I think also for people with lived experience to participate and to point out issues with the current system or the way that things are viewed or treated or not necessarily treated the best. So I think that has really fascinated me recently. And I was supposed to go to a conference last month. Unfortunately, it...
Which one was it?
So it's the American Association of Suicidology.
Oh, okay. I was supposed to go to a conference last month too. I thought it was the same one, but not same one. Okay, keep going.
No, but actually I had won a travel scholarship to go because that scholarship was to, I think, reach out to people with lived experience and kind of give them the opportunity to connect to all these people in the field of suicidology. And I think that that's really important. And I hope that the field continues to grow and especially listen to people who have lived through having suicidal thoughts and or behaviors and having that collaboration between the people with lived experience and the researchers.
Well, I think that's incredibly important work. You know, actually, right before I started talking to you this afternoon, I had my one of my medical school classes, and I gave a presentation actually on how it's very, very, very likely that because of coronavirus, we're seeing a huge spike in unemployment rates. And unemployment rates are actually correlated with an increase in suicides. So sadly, it could be a secondary effect of this coronavirus that I feel like is not getting enough attention. So, you know, I think that work you're doing is incredibly, incredibly important. And that is really, really cool and badass. So, you know, we have about 5 more minutes here. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Let's imagine, you know, there's a listener out there who's tuning in, who, you know, your story reminds them a lot of their own experiences. You know, what advice would you give them? What advice do you think could help a person like that?
Sure. So I think that it is really important to kind of have plans in place ahead of time. Some people think that they can put off seeking treatment, whether that is medication or therapy or something else until they need it. But then at that point, it can be really hard to access the help that they need or to even be motivated enough to ask for the help. So I think that is really important before someone is in a crisis state, whether that is a severe depressive episode or manic episode, to have plans in place to kind of know what to do and what their red flags are. And so hopefully if an episode is about to happen, they can kind of stop it in its tracks with the help of professionals.
I think that's great. You know, you know, I really like the idea of people trying to get help before shit hits the fan. You know, I certainly didn't do that, but I wish I had done that. So I think that's wonderful, wonderful advice. So, you know, I know, you know, you graduated from UNC, you know, you're super passionate about all these different things. Something I'm passionate about is trying to create and motivate individuals with lived experience to become some means of a provider, you know, whether that, of course, be like me going the medical school route or maybe a clinician, maybe a peer support counselor. You know, do you ever see yourself maybe trying to become a therapist or something similar?
I hope to be. I have to see. I'm kind of in different roles right now to hopefully build up my CV and to see, do I like to do research or through the victim advocacy, do I like to be one-on-one with people and kind of see what path I'd like to take within the mental health field, because there are obviously so many different degree pathways or different fields within the overall mental health field. Given that I do have bipolar disorder, I personally have some concerns whether or not grad school would trigger an episode, because a lot of people already talk about how stressful the entire grad school experience is. And so sometimes for me, that's a personal consideration. And then there's also the issue of having bipolar disorder openly, and you can just Google my name and bipolar disorder will pop up, and I don't know how that will affect my application, honestly.
You know, those are all valid concerns. And you know, like you said, you kind of got connected with me after that one episode where I kind of talked extensively about that. Right. And I would just counter, you know, you have so many more tools and so much more knowledge how to better handle your bipolar disorder now that, you know, while it definitely will be challenging, it 100% will be stressful. You probably could face some means of discrimination, you know, because you like live like I do openly about your bipolar. But I don't think that's anything you can't overcome. And I truly, with my whole heart, believe that. And you know, I have the utmost respect for you. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. You have some great artwork I saw on your Instagram page. And so can you remind the listeners again, what's the best way for them to kind of get in touch with you, to follow your work?
Sure. So I am on multiple platforms. So thecalculatingmind.com is my blog. And on Twitter, I am at calculatingmind. And on Instagram, I'm at the_calculating_mind. So I'm kind of all over the place.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I think we're about to get booted from our free version of Zoom here anyway. So I think it's a good time maybe for us to wrap up. Well, thank you again so much. This has been awesome. It's really been such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye.
The "I didn't realize you liked me that way" deal. Because it's one thing to receive McDonald's, but an entirely other thing to know that they woke up early to face the world and bring you McDonald's breakfast still hot in the bag.
Appreciate you.
There's a deal for every morning. Now grab two loaded sausage burritos for only $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Now through February 16th, join a clean and spacious Planet Fitness for zero enrollment and only $10 a month. With tons of equipment and free fitness training, it's the perfect place for everybody to work out.
Even me, Mr. I can't sleep at night, so I keep dozing off during the day.
Especially you, Snoozy. You'll rest easier and feel fit-tacular.
Wait, how did you get in here?
Join in club or at planetfitness.com. Zero enrollment, $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Hurry, deal ends February 16th. See club for details.